I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is October 4th, 2009. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's story by Christopher Hitchens. Engaging with Iran is like having sex with someone who hates you. Living in the Islamic Republic, wrote Azar Nafisi in her book Reading Lolita in Tehran in 2003, is like having sex with a man you loathe. This verdict has gathered extra force and pungency as the succeeding years have elapsed and as more women have been stoned, hanged, beaten, raped, and silenced. Lately has come the news that Iranian men in prison are being raped too, for trying to exercise their right to vote. And now the U.S. government has come to a point where it must ask itself, what is it like to enter negotiations with a man who loathes you and who every Friday holds public prayers that call for your death? Last Friday brought the news that the Obama administration had accepted an offer from Tehran, delivered the preceding Wednesday, for the holding of what the New York Times called unconditional talks. It was further reported that the administration had spent less than 48 hours deliberating whether to respond to the invitation, which yields the interesting, if minor, detail that this must have been the most significant decision taken by Obama's people on or about the 8th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th. A couple of weeks after the June 12th election, Benjamin Weinthal suggested six ways President Obama could influence Iran. In August, an undercover journalist reported on the mood in Tehran. Christopher Hitchens reminded us of why we're in a war against Islamic terrorism. Well, I am all for talks without preconditions, and I have said several times in this space that I think we should offer the Iranians cooperation on a wide spectrum of topics, especially the very pressing one of helping to proof Iran against the coming earthquake that could devastate its capital city. There may even be areas of potential interest in our having common enemies in the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But things have changed a little since the President and his Secretary of State were sparring over the word unconditional during the primaries. First, it has become ever clearer that Iran's uranium enrichment and centrifuge program has put it within measurable distance of the ability to weaponize its nuclear capacity. Second, it has become obscenely obvious that the theocracy is prepared to govern by force alone and to employ the most appalling measures to remain in power without a mandate. It would be nice to know, even if no conditions or preconditions are to be exacted, whether the administration has assured itself on two points. The first of these is, do we seriously expect the Islamic Republic to be negotiating in good faith about its nuclear program? And the second is, what do we know about the effect of these proposed talks on the morale and the leadership of the Iranian opposition? One presumes that the Mahmoud Ahmadinejad regime had its own reasons for firing off a five-page document proposing negotiations that including Britain, France, Russia, Germany, and China. The much-stalled group of countries that have conducted business with Iran so far. The letter was sent out in the same period that the Russian government opposed any further sanctions on Iran for non-cooperation. In the same period that Ahmadinejad announced that Iran would never halt its nuclear fuel production, and in the run-up to Ahmadinejad's next appearance at the podium of the United Nations toward the end of this month. Might it be possible that this latest initiative from Tehran is yet another attempt to buy time or run out the clock? Meanwhile, it is certainly the case that at least three of the six countries approached are being asked to negotiate under some kind of duress. In an unpardonable violation of diplomatic immunity, employees of the French and British embassies in Tehran have been placed under arrest and subjected to show trials since the convulsions that attended the coup mounted by the Revolutionary Guards in June. and the Iranian correspondent of Newsweek magazine, who is also a Canadian citizen, has been held incommunicado for almost the same length of time. Without overstressing any preconditions, it doesn't seem too much to require of the Iranian regime that it not send out invitations to countries whose citizens or locally engaged diplomatic staff it is holding as hostages. On the larger question of the breach by Iran of all its undertakings about nuclear weapons and the amazing absence from its diplomatic note of any mention of its own program, one wasn't too reassured by the lazy phrasing of Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The Obama administration, she said, would not impose artificial deadlines on Ahmadinejad. Why is this not reassuring? Because it's impossible to tell what is meant by an artificial deadline. Would one prefer a genuine deadline whereby, for example, the United Nations required Iran to demonstrate compliance with the relevant Security Council resolutions on nuclear proliferation, or face further UN-mandated sanctions? Certainly one would, but this isn't what Ambassador Rice appears to have meant. From all appearances, then, this seems like another snow job from the mullahs. And did the State Department or the CIA take any soundings in those 48 hours between receipt of the mullah's letter and our response to it among the leaders of Iranian civil society? Given the short interval, it seems that the thought did not even occur to them. Here is what I heard from Professor Abbas Milani, the director of Iranian studies at Stanford University. When you read the Iranian letter and realize how empty of earnest negotiating position it in fact is, you are left with no choice but to conclude that they are relying on their ally in Putin's Russia to veto any resolutions against them. For the Russians to be able to even pretend to be serious in their talk of no need for more pressure on the regime, Tehran has also to pretend to be serious in negotiation. This analysis appears to conform to all the available facts as we know them. A bit too much like having sex with someone who loathes you. And now we move to the science segment. Today, vampires. A vampire is a mythical creature who overcomes death by sucking the blood from living humans. The most common variation of the myth portrays the vampire as a dead person who rises from the grave at night to seek his victim from the realm of the sleeping. The vampire is a popular theme of filmmakers, who have started with Bram Stoker's novel, Dracula, and added a number of variations to the theme. For example, the ability to fly like the vampire bat, a lust for beautiful women as victims who then become vampires upon being bitten, fear of the symbol of the Christian cross, the repelling power of garlic or garlic flowers, and death by sunlight or by a special stake driven through the heart, a fitting death for a character commonly believed to be based on the 15th century warrior Vlad the Impaler. However, according to Elizabeth Miller, author of Dracula, Sense and Nonsense, Bram Stoker did not base his vampire count on Vlad the Impaler. He borrowed Vlad's nickname, Dracula, for a vampire character he had already conceived. Legends of blood-sucking creatures are found in many cultures throughout history. One of the more popular bloodsuckers of our age is the chupacabra. The vampire is also a popular literary subject. Hence, there are numerous descriptions of the origin, nature, powers, etc. of vampires. What seems to be universal about vampire myths is their connection with the fear of death and the desire for immortality. The ritual drinking of blood to overcome death has been practiced by many peoples. The Aztecs and other Native Americans, for example, ate the hearts and drank the blood of captives in ritual ceremonies, most likely to satisfy the appetite of their gods and gain for themselves fertility and immortality. Also typical were the rites of Dionysus and Mithras, where the drinking of animal blood was required in the quest for immortality. Even today, some Christians believe that their priests perform a magical transubstantiation of bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ to be eaten and drunk in the quest to join God in eternal life. We might say we've made progress in our ritualistic quest to overcome death. First, we sacrificed humans and drank their blood to keep the gods alive and happy, or to join them in overcoming death. We later came to substitute bulls or other animals for humans to achieve our goal. Finally, we progressed to a vegetarian menu of bread and wine. Even so, the basic truth is depressing. For anything to live, something or someone else must die. Whether this truth sets you free or not depends on your place at or on the dinner table. Since we are deep into metaphors, we may as well note here that the vampire has become a metaphor for those who define and create themselves by destroying others. People whose lives center on destroying other people's lives by disempowering them, who reduce their victims to dependent subjects to be lorded over, have been called spiritual vampires. Some of the therapists, ministers, and gurus could be called spiritual vampires. This cultural link between vampirism and the quest for immortality seems to have been subordinated in literature and film, where other themes such as blood for blood's sake, fear for fear's sake, or entrance into the realm of the occult seem to dominate. One sign of the cultural deterioration of our ancestors' noble quest for immortality can be seen in the modern secondary meaning of vampire, a woman who exploits and ruins her lover. Another example of deterioration can be seen in the numerous www sites on vampires which appeal to occult or New Age interests, such as entering the so-called dark sides of reality, gaining power, establishing a unique identity as a special person, or selling commercial products and games. Apparently, role-playing and masquerading as vampires is not enough to satisfy the bloodlust of some people, and covens or cults of vampires have emerged among some occultists. They seek blood to give them power, a sexual rush, or to establish a unique and special fictional persona based on creating fear and mystery in others. Unlike our ancient ancestors, their power is not sought because of fear based on ignorance and misunderstanding of nature, but on ignorance and misunderstanding of themselves. Like other occult cults, these vampire covens are attractive to the young and the weak. Just a few years ago, such vampires would have been considered ill or evil. Today, they are said to have an alternative lifestyle. Some may be misfits who really believe they can draw energy from each other and who feel a sense of superiority over those who aren't part of their inner group. And now the arena goes abroad. Today, we travel to Scandinavia to fight female circumcision. Sweden, Denmark, and Norway try to stop genital mutilation among immigrants at home and abroad. When she was 11, a Swedish-born girl was taken on vacation to her mother's native Somalia. The mother wanted to make her daughter clean and paid a man to cut off her daughter's clitoris and labia while two women held her down. Afterward, the girl was stitched to her urethra. No anesthesia was used. Last year, at age 19, a Swedish court convicted the mother for those illegal acts, awarding the victim record damages. Scandinavians, rather than quietly recoiling as immigrant mothers take their Europe-born daughters on vacation to Africa to be circumcised, are fighting the traffic in female genital mutilation. Sweden, Norway, and Denmark are doggedly pursuing perpetrators of female genital mutilation practiced by African and Middle Eastern cultures. These perpetrators are mostly the immigrant mothers of young girls. Jail sentences, record damages, and controversial immigration laws are Scandinavia's weapons in this war. Meanwhile, Africans, who have immigrated with their families for a better life in Northern Europe, wring their hands, imploring Westerners to understand that they are doing what they think is best for their daughters. The reasons given for female circumcision are traditional, cultural, and religious. It is believed to encourage cleanliness, to control promiscuity, enhance the male's sexual pleasure, preserve virginity, and protect against unwanted pregnancies. But Scandinavian leaders refused to interpret tolerance of female circumcision as politically correct. Female genital mutilation is a very serious assault on children. It is important that they will be given a chance to value this independently when they are old enough to understand. In Scandinavian countries, female circumcision is illegal, even if it happens in another country, and even if the practice is legal in that country. It does not matter if the victim said yes, it is still illegal. Perpetrators, such as girls' parents, are being prosecuted upon return to Scandinavia and face up to 10 years in prison. My hat goes off to those people who have the courage to stand up. If only other European countries and Western nations showed such courage rather than caving in under the fear of the threat of religious discrimination. Back to the article, the graphic details revealed in the ensuing trials have shocked people here. Young women have told horrible stories confirmed by medical reports. In Norway, the Immigration Appeals Board has allowed African families to remain in the country even if they do not fulfill immigration criteria. The board fears that sending families back to Africa will leave their daughters vulnerable to circumcision. In 50 cases of asylum applications rejected by the Norwegian Directorate of Immigration, appeals were filed not by the families as usual, but by the appeals board itself. Female genital cutting is a serious assault and contradicts basic human rights. Earlier this year, a Danish court handed down the country's first jail sentence for carrying out female circumcision. A 40-year-old mother from Eritrea, where circumcision is practiced among more than 98% of the female population, according to the World Health Organization, was sentenced to 2 years in jail after forcing her two daughters, 10 and 12, to be circumcised on a trip to Sudan in 2003. When the parents planned another trip to Sudan with their 6-year-old daughter, the two elder girls alerted other adults. The police seized the parents, and the shocking story took center stage in Danish media for months. The father claimed he had no idea what was happening and was acquitted of any charges. Although women are often responsible for the practical arrangements, members of the extended family are usually involved in the decision-making. Female genital mutilation is a manifestation of gender equality. It represents society's control over women. Without support from men in societies where female genital mutilation is practiced, it will never be stopped. There is often an expectation that men will marry only circumcised women. Anyone departing from the norm may face harassment and ostracism. In Eritrea, if a girl is not a virgin, she will be returned to her parents' home after marriage. Circumcision is seen as evidence that a girl is a virgin. Well, I don't understand that one. Maybe I'm just naive. Back to the article. Mbaye of IOM, who is originally from Kenya, where circumcision rates affect about 32% of the female population, said that for these reasons, mothers are reluctant to object to the circumcision of their daughters. Women in most African communities are taken as second-class citizens. Although the mothers may not want to circumcise their daughters, it is often very difficult for them to openly oppose the practice. It would be a bold woman to stand up against a practice that has been endorsed by all her women ancestors for centuries. So Scandinavian governments are trying to stand up for the women. The Swedish government has launched a national campaign trying to stop female circumcision in Sweden, including among immigrants without citizenship. It has also moved to support girls and women in Sweden who already are victims of circumcision. The act directs Swedish schools, preschools, hospitals, local health centers, social services, police authorities, and prosecutors to understand, prevent, and deal with circumcision. Police and prosecutors have attended regional conferences on how to do that. A new law in Norway that goes into effect nationwide on January 1st will offer free genital screenings to all girls immigrating from countries where 30% or more women are circumcised. If the offer is not accepted, immigration authorities can alert the Children's Welfare Institution. Girls who reside in Norway will have health checks in the 5th and 10th grades. Genital cutting is illegal and results in incurable damage for the victims. Therefore, we launched this additional rule. Laws regarding female circumcision were adopted in Sweden in 1982, in Norway in 1986, and in Denmark in 2003. In the U.S., it has been a federal crime since 1997 to conduct female genital mutilation on anyone younger than 18. However, IOM believes approaches must be delicate. Forceful means, including laws, will not bring any success, Mbaye said. The approach should be respectful and not militant. The whole issue needs careful talking and patience where the communities concerned are slowly but readily educated. So in the meantime, we just cut off all their clitorises and say, okay, well, we'll get around to it someday. Getting back to the article, but patience and slow action is not the Scandinavian approach. Hear, hear. I totally agree. 14 reports on female circumcision are under investigation at the Oslo Police Department, and in June, Norway's parliament made a move that is likely to increase that number even more. The statute of limitations was changed from 10 years after the offense occurred to 10 years after the victim turns 18. And now for the final segment of the show, famous quotes. Today, Dr. Lawrence Johnston Peter, born 1919, died 1990 at the age of 70. He was an educator best known to the general public for the formulation of the Peter Principle. He began his career as a teacher in 1941. He received the degree of Doctor of Education from Washington State University in 1963. In 1964, Peter moved to California, where he became an associate professor of education and director of the Evelyn Friedan Center for Prescriptive Teaching and coordinator of programs for emotionally disturbed children at USC. He became widely famous in 1968 on the publication of the Peter Principle, which goes like this. In a hierarchy, every employee tends to rise to his level of incompetence. In time, every post tends to be occupied by an employee who is incompetent to carry out his duties. Work is accomplished by those employees who have not yet reached their level of incompetence. And now for some quotes from Lawrence Peter. The noblest of all dogs is the hot dog. It feeds the hand that bites it. His next quote, there are two kinds of failures, those who thought and never did, and those who did and never thought. And finally, great minds discuss ideas. Average minds discuss events. Small minds discuss people.
Are you ready, Bruce? Start walking.